So this is about esoteric instructions. I think we should first define the word esoteric. Stefan, who was here, mentioned, don't call it a mystery school, because they're just, it's a nice myth that there were schools where people were taught this. But for instance, in ancient Greece, the Eleusinian Mysteries, in every culture, there are people, of course, who have the religion, but there are people who have philosophy, have a philosophical interpretation. So the Mysteries took a common myth, like that of Persephone, who is walking through this beautiful field of colorful flowers. That alone should be a flag right there. To the field, she's stooping down to reach the flowers, and the earth opens up, and Hades, the lord of the underworld, pulls her down into this gloomy underworld. And of course, it represented the human soul attracted to the senses with all those beautiful colors and flowers, and then imprisoned in the underworld, where our true state is to go back to this world of vivid, vivid colors and light. In ancient Egypt, there were temples, but like India today, you know, there was no communal worship. People would be going in and out. And even in the temples, people really didn't go in constantly. The gods were brought out for a procession. That was when people would see them. So, of course, there were always philosophical minds, especially in our ancestors, those philosophers in ancient Alexandria, as David psychically intuited in my talk. But Alexandria was this great city in Egypt, right on the coast, founded by Alexander the Great, of course, named after Alexander, Alexandria. The remarkable thing about it, it was a cosmopolitan city. There were Greeks, there were Egyptians, there was this melding of people, and it was famous for its great library of Alexandria. They had this wonderful library where they tried to collect all the great literature of the world. So HPB constantly says that our lineage goes back to those great people. The instructors of the great Neoplatonist. And one of the things I think she would be remarkably proud of, or saying, see, I told you so, is that esotericism is not only an academic study today, acknowledged, but acknowledged as part of European history. In Europe, this study is far greater than it is here in the US. Perhaps showing that esotericism showed a certain tolerance for other ideas. But this wonderful handbook, I'll just read you this comment because it's very germane to our topic. Mysticism and esotericism are two intimately related strands of the Western tradition. Despite their close connections, however, scholars tend to treat them separately. Whereas the study of Western mysticism enjoys a long and established history, Western esotericism is a young field. And so, of course, it goes on that this book shows why mysticism and esotericism must be examined together if either is to be understood fully. And, of course, it's brought together all of these great scholars who have contributed to it. And I was happy to be asked to write the chapter on theosophy, especially being included in a book that so many of the people I admire and have influenced my own work. When we come to 1875, as you all know, the Theosophical Society was started in 1875, but in 1888, it was given a new impulse, sort of a new direction by HPB herself. And in this book, thankfully published by the Theosophical Publishing House at Adyar, it contains her memorandum to why she started this section. And I would highly recommend reading this document because it is one of our foundation documents in our history, seeing what she expected. And she starts out by saying that the Theosophical Society has just entered upon its 14th year of existence, And if it has accomplished great, one may almost say stupendous results on the exoteric and utilitarian plane, it has proved a dead failure on all of those points which rank foremost among the objects of its establishment. And then she goes on to point out why that though the society existed, it was not like the society today. People met, they heard lectures, they discussed topics, and that was pretty well it. That nucleus that was foremost really hadn't occurred. It was just a bunch of people going to different things. In Mr. Sinnett's lodge in London, people had to wear full evening dress. And I mean, not just a coat and ties, as some of us remember even existed in the 60s. You had to have tails. You know, the women had to have the full evening dresses, the gloves. C.G. Narayanadasa said they always recognized Mr. Sinnett when they met on the other side because they would all be wearing white robes and he would still be wearing a full evening dress. So she felt that it hadn't had that nucleus that she wanted. And she says that the masters can give but little assistance to a body not thoroughly united in purpose and feeling, and which breaks its first fundamental rule, universal brotherly love without distinction of race, creed, color, or caste. Nor to a society, many members of which pass their lives in judging, condemning, and often reviling other members in a most untheosophical, not to say disgraceful, manner. And her rules, first and foremost, were not so much about not doing things. You know, if you were in the ES, you were asked that if you could exist on a meat diet, without a meat diet, to try it. But fish and poultry was acceptable, you know. So, of course, Colonel Olcott and Madame Levetsky and Mr. Judge all ate meat. Mr. Judge was a big fan of porterhouse steak. So, you know, I think their idea that it wasn't what went into a man's mouth that made him pure or impure, but what was in his heart. They all smoked, like chimneys. Could you imagine going to a lodge meeting where people were constantly smoking? First and foremost, HPB, constantly rolling away. They said she could write and roll at the same time. Maybe that's where we get that comment about being a holy roller. But the only thing, she didn't like alcohol. She never did. Didn't see the point of it, so there was no alcohol drinking. But she wanted a group that had a cohesiveness. And of course, she thought that in this section, there would be that much more. So just one other thing in this side that she comments in a letter at this time. To live like cats and dogs in the TS is positively against all rules and the wishes of the masters, as against our brotherhood, so-called, and all its rules. They are disgusted. They look on, and in that look, oh Lord, if you could only see what I have seen, there is a deep ocean of sad disgust, contempt, and sorrow. So we are not just working for ourselves and having our own little dramas, but there are those behind this movement who are there to relieve the suffering of the world. And the last thing we want to do is cause them more unhappiness. So it's not only for ourselves that we're working. These instructions she issued to her school. She issued three during her lifetime, mainly in 1889. And then she stopped. Issued three, and then she stopped. And then she started her own group of students, six men and six women, that met every Wednesday. Thursday night was the lodge meeting. And so every Wednesday would meet in her room, and they all had a special chair. I've actually seen those chairs have survived. Actually sat in one of them. Didn't do anything for me, I suppose. But they actually had a chair with their names on it, and they all, six women on one side and six men on the other. And she would then answer their questions and give them oral teaching. So this book also has those oral instructions. those of us who write a lot, especially books, these books are like our children. They are something special to us. It isn't just an inanimate object and it's done. They are all part and parcel of us. It's a means of expressing. Musicians can produce a song, poets can produce poetry, even those of us who simply annotate produce these things. And I must tell you, this is one of my favorite books. Part and parcel because it could only be produced at the Theosophical Publishing House today in a reasonable cost. You can't have big fold-out diagrams and things like that. And giving these presentations in a number of places, of course, I had one lady who came to me and said, "Who are you to publish the Esoteric Instructions?" Even though they've been in print since 1897, right, and are all over the internet. "Who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm nobody, but when I compiled it, I sent it to the head of the esoteric school, and she's the one you should take that up with, not me, Rhoda Bernier." And she's the person who decided to publish it. And in fact, she was going to read the proofs with me, but the poor woman decided to die instead. But it's a remarkable book, and I still read it. Now, she starts off these instructions with a warning. A warning, a warning, a warning. And that is because when you turn your attention to these ideas, certain things happen, right? Certain things come to the fore. Students must not look for tests and trials of a special nature. These will come in the affairs of men and their relation to others. Specific tests in general will not be given, but even the manner in which the student approaches these teachings will be itself a test or a trial. So even the way we come to this is a test or a trial. The masters do not judge students simply by their ability to do this or that special or difficult thing, but by the actual self-development and accomplishment. In entering this section, the student begins to look his own nature in the face, and in accordance with the intensity of his aspirations will be his difficulties. These difficulties may exhibit themselves on the physiological, mental, moral, or psychic planes of his being, or in the circumstances of his life. And the wonderful thing I found about, after having done this, you know, when you do these books, you really don't have a chance to read them. You're constantly meeting a deadline, getting it together. And what, ever since it's been published, I've been just reading a few paragraphs every night. And I must tell you, I've had the good opportunity in this life when I finally have that life review that we're all told about. There was an old lady who used to take care of Annie Besant, Annie Wilson, spent her whole life doing it. And Annie Besant had died, and when she was dying, her only comment was, "I have known Annie Besant. I have known Annie Besant." So to me, to be able to have read through all of her stuff, these instructions hold together better than anything else. You know, she refers to The Secret Doctrine as an exoteric book. She does, because it's published and it's all out there. But in this, I thought she could probably write a little freer, write for a certain group of people. And I'm sure she knew eventually it would be published. The thing that makes these instructions different, the first thing she starts out by teaching you is the mantra, the power of sound, the power of the om. Pranava, as it's called in India, the breath. Our international vice president has written an excellent article on Om that was reprinted in The Theosophist, Dr. Chittaranj Chattopadhyay, and a really good, if you want background on that, an excellent study on the word Om. This is an extremely sacred word in India. As they say, the Vedas, which are the corpus, the heart of Indian philosophy, mass thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. Imagine what people had to memorize. People had to memorize all of these things. Chants, they're all chant, they're hymns, they're chants, but it's all tone, you know, the vibration would have an effect, the fire sacrifice. The word Aryan means that noble, means that those who are participating in this sacrifice. And they say that the entire Vedic corpus is contained in this wonderful mantra, the Gayatri, which is a beautiful mantra. And the Gayatri, the essence of the Gayatri, is simply contained in this word Om. And as HBB points out, it could be a three-syllabled word, a two-syllable, it can be A-U-M. Remember, it's study. Imagine, it's like the three worlds, right? Om, you're ending with the dental. You're starting in the back. So air, is going through the palate, becoming a oo. And then the dental, the clip, but it's a nasal M, so it's vibrating constantly. And the Vedas tell us that it should be pronounced audibly. It should be pronounced in a low voice and then silently. So this idea of these three stages, the three worlds, one of the great Indian fables is the story of Vishnu in one of his little incarnations as a little dwarf. And the demons who were so, he was like a court jester, and he asked for a boon. They're very big about giving you boons in India if you do something good, which is a good thing. So he asked for a boon, and the only thing he asked is, he would take three steps, and he would want everything in those three steps to be given to him. So they laughed, this little dwarf, right? Well, what? How much can he take? His first step covered the earth to the heavens. His second step covered from the heavens to the infinity, and the third step beyond, right? That they had made there. So this idea of threes, in the early Theosophical Society, it was all about threes, body, soul, and spirit. The physical body, the soul, what we would consider mind, and then spirit. So she has a mantra. She goes into this mantra is the power of sound. Especially the mantra she gives in this is Om Mani Padme Hum, which is another beautiful mantra. It is carved. Those of you who went to Tibet have probably seen it carved all over the country. It was given by the great Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, for the Tibetan people as a protection. And again, she points out that it is a seven-syllable mantra. The other things that are in here are her correspondences. So she gives color. One of the areas that Theosophy has made a big impact is in art and sound and music. She lists the color scale and the tones that go with them. So those early 20th century artists and musicians were quite familiar with this material because Annie Besant published it in the third volume of The Secret Doctrine. And as I say, even till today, there are people who are complaining that you've made something secret available. But I'm sure when Mrs. Besant decided to publish it, she asked the master himself. She was not somebody who would just on a whim do something. So this idea of color, number, and sound. But there is something that is unique to all of this. First, every initiator has their own system. And this system of correspondences go back to ancient times. A correspondence is a great line from Mr. Judge that a correspondence is a likeness, not an identity. A correspondence is a likeness, not an identity. So things correspond to other things. A golden flower would be similar to the sun, but not meaning the flower is the sun. They share certain correspondences because in this wonderful book, she has this chart showing you things interacting and flowing from the highest plane down to the intermediate, down to the human. All of these things are interconnected. And in saying that, you know, with all of this stuff, there is the implied and then the implicit. Aside from all of these words and all of this stuff, she's telling us something else, and that is correspondences are all about relationships, when you figure it. It's all about relationships. Everything is sharing a relationship. and certain things will work together, certain things won't. So the thing that really is unique, and she didn't publish in any of her writings, though she hints at all of this throughout, is the idea of the seven principles. Now, this is one thing she said that all of her students should learn. She, before modern psychology, she had already divided the individual into a number of layers and faculties. And I think this is one of those things where, you know, you do a test, you pull them all in and you say, okay, what are the seven principles? That's like a prayer for a Christian, the Lord's Prayer. What are the seven principles? So of course, in the published literature, which came through Mr. Sinnett's esoteric Buddhism, there's the physical body. We all know we have a physical body, right? There is the subtle body, what was called the astral body. In the later literature, the etheric body. There is the etheric body, because they're so linked. The prana, the energy, the life breath. Kama rupa. It's kama, but it becomes kama rupa only after you die. After you die, then there's this vehicle for carrying all this stuff. Manas, buddhi, and Atman, the divine reality. Now, when she does these teachings, she gives it in a certain different way. Thank God I've written some of this stuff. I'd never remember it. But she's given them as this, that, of course, she says that the body and Atman are not principles. The body, the physical body, is like the rind of the fruit. It is the exterior shell, like a coconut. So the subtle body is not a body, a separate thing unto itself. It is the husk of this inner pattern body. This is why subtle healing modalities work, things like therapeutic touch. They're affecting the physical, but they work through the subtle. They're not just working on the physical. So there is this subtle body, the image formed in the womb. Desire. We all have desires. All want that last piece of cookie or cake. Lower mind, the mind then that is thinking about our physical needs. Am I going to pay my bills on time? Where do I have to be? Then the higher mind that occasionally when we meet like this and talk about these ideas, because where else in the world are you going to have a chance to meet people, talk and discuss these ideas? And I said thanks to Tim, is that one of the things about these meetings is the chance of so many people talking and exchanging ideas. We have the theory and, hey, well, you know about this, you know about that. They use brotherhood in the old days. You know, we're still the heirs of those Victorians, but it really is, you can't even say brotherhood and sisterhood. It's about family. It's about community. And in this interaction, is our teachings put in practice? When we share a smile, when we are happy together, when we turn our thoughts to these higher ideals, and old-fashioned theosophists like Mr. C.W. Leadbeater would have said, you know, when we meet like this, it's a fulcrum. It's a force for higher forces to come into the world. That's the way they talked back then. So higher mind, and then this intuition. We all have this intuition. People always say, why are these theosophical books so hard? I was in London many years ago at a secret doctrine class done by my friend Tony Maddock, who is the executor of the Mahatma Letters Trust. That trust is still in existence, and he keeps it going. And they read through the secret doctrine page by page by page. People have died during it. People have come in, new people. And sometimes there'd be a handful of people, sometimes, then there were three people in this, and adding myself. And there was a girl who came in and she says, you know what, I don't think I'm going to come back to this today. She said, why does everything in this book have to mean something else? Right? So Tony being Tony, they just plugged on. I think it was the chapter about trees and serpents and that sort of thing. And so everybody had a page and read through it, and she was reading through it, and then suddenly she said, oh, so that means that. She had that aha moment that we didn't see. Something made a connection for her. That book, those words opened up a faculty that she hadn't had. We couldn't see it. I must ask him if she came back. So the seventh prana, you know, HPB had a big battle with a very learned Indian member, T. Subba Rao. T. Subba Rao was going to write the secret doctrine with her, and she kept sending the manuscript to India. And there's the manuscript. Is Subba Rao calling now? He says, and he's saying, don't drag me into this. No, that was long ago, and don't drag me into it now, okay? But he had a big disagreement with her about these seven principles. And he quite firmly stated that the seven principles that is listed in Theosophical works are not erroneous. He said they're erroneous. They are no. Of course, being Hindu, he used the fourfold scheme where they have four principles, four bodies instead, physical, emotional, intuitional, spiritual. But he said, no. And they had a long correspondence in the Theosophist. I don't think they'd happen today, but they were going back and forth and nobody was yielding an inch until they finally agreed to disagree. Though he did admit that there is a sevenfold classification, but not what was found in the Theosophical books published. So there are these seven principles that we are really complex beings, multidimensional beings. Dora Kunz used to say that the clairvoyant who looked at the person could see which chakra was turning, so on what level we're functioning. We are all functioning on various levels. And this is the basis of modern psychology, seeing the fragmented self. She was one of the first to give this idea of us functioning on many different levels. And to bore you even further, I'm just going to throw in this idea of where did these seven principles come from? I always ask the Theosophists, is it like you're just born with a soul? You're just born with seven principles and that's it? But, you know, HPB gives us enough hints. We are all so obsessed with the physical form. In New York, you'd be surprised how many people will not walk but will go on a bicycle in a gym and pay hundreds of dollars to pedal away. We spend so much on the physical element. But in her books, it helps us develop that mental and spiritual world. It is like spiritual bodybuilding. And it doesn't have to make sense to you. I keep telling people, they say, well, it doesn't have to make sense. Well, it shouldn't, or else you'd be a Mahatma, you know? But it's to exercise the mind. As I always point out, even with this material, it is not to inform the mind, but to train the mind. Once you start seeing connections, then you start being informed. So it is a means of making us think. And as she points out, you know, we are the forerunners of the sixth subrace, which is going to happen right here in America. The subrace is coming here, and because America, unlike anywhere else, sorry, Linda, anywhere else, is a culture that is truly, you know, what is the one word we think of as America? The melting pot. It's the melting pot. White people today are not white people 100 years ago. I mean, if you were Anglo-Saxon, you were white. If you were Irish or German or Italian, you were not really part in that. But over the generations, they've all melded. The New York Times had a supplement in the year 2000 about the future face of America, where, Tomoto Shaughnessy, you know, somebody who was Japanese and Irish American. All of these groups are melding and creating under our own eyes very slowly a new race. So let me just tell you this idea, because she hints about this in The Secret Doctrine. Let me sum up that book in about the 1 minute I have left. There's seven principles. Right? There's seven races. There's seven rounds. So we've been through four rounds. We're in the fourth round. You know, we went through stages that were mineral, animal, mineral, plant, animal. Not physical plants or animals, or we weren't giant ferns at one time, just blowing in the wind, you know. We were, you know, but creating the forms of those things, what it meant to be that way. And in the fourth one, we are human, because the humanity really is the crown of creation in her scheme. We are human, and we've been through five stages. We're in the fifth. Of course, there were those, and the first two races were unconscious. So, and think of our heritage and our paternity. We are divine beings. We are from those great lunar pitries, our ancestors. Our nature is a divine nature that has come into generation, come into this world. The lunar pitries, she said, can never die. They were imperishable. They were divine. Imagine a planet before anything, even solidity, gaseous. But these forms were there. She says that the primitive form of every form of life is ovoid. Ovoid. Our planet is really ovoid. It's not a big round circle as we imagine. The galaxies are all ovoid. What is the oldest living form in this world but those protozoa, those invisible little cells that split? So the first race was imperishable. So what principle is that? What principle doesn't die, if you exclude Atma? Of course, she calls it the aura. The auric egg is like a time capsule carrying all of your existences. When you go to a psychic and she says, I see such and such and such and such, she's seeing those patterns that the auric egg is like a time capsule carrying innumerable existences. It's like a seed bank. So everything is there. But those, they were unconscious. There was no need for anything. They were blissfully unconscious of everything. They didn't need hands, feet, or anything because there was nothing to eat or grow. I mean, they were all living in a gaseous world. As time passes, things solidify. This astral atmosphere comes into being. So you get these sort of semi-fluid entities. That's the pattern body. You know, it's a subtle body, but it's there. It's there. We were just a bunch of blobs, you know, squirming around in existence. And then, of course, the third race, those giant Lemurians, right? You know, there's one drawing of them walking. They had a third eye, but it wasn't in the front. It was in the back, according to her. The pineal gland is where the third eye was. There's some drawing I saw based on a second generation theosophical literature with these giant forms walking a dinosaur like a pet. And supposedly those heads on Easter Island represent, are not them, but representations of these great civilization that perished, that was in the Pacific. And of course, their remnants still exist today. And then of course, we get Atlantis. Good old Atlantis. Remember Atlantis, everybody? Wasn't that a great place, you know? They talk about technology now. I tell you, that was Atlantis, right? That was a great place to be. I tell you what, wonderful civilization, like in representation like the Aztecs. Beautiful structures, wonderful, you know, beliefs. But they'd cut your heart out in a second to sacrifice it, you know? Plato talks about Atlantis being surrounded by these seven moats. And when the conquistadors came to Mexico City, it was actually built surrounded by these moats. And of course, those pyramids are there. The Aztecs saw these men in these metal outfits, glimmering, pale. They had come down from the sky, from the boat. They were the original boat people, I suppose. They come, and so they offer them the sacred beverage that they give to the gods, which is a mixture of tequila, chili, and cocoa. So this, they would give you this before they sacrificed you. Well, if you drank that, you'd just want to have your heart cut out. Just end it. And they gave them this mixture of tequila and hot chilies and cocoa. And of course, they took one drink of it, and they were so enraged that they slaughtered all the Aztecs. So this Atlantis was there. It's a hard thing to talk about, because now that we know about continental drift, where does it fit in? Because continents were supposedly all together. Where was this Atlantis if these continents sort of split apart? As HBB herself points out, you know, she said that all her students were abominably literal. Abominably literal. So don't take this too literally. In fact, she says there's 7 levels of interpretation with all of this. But so in the third race, by the way, desire awoke. You know, they were bisexual, gigantic beings that were both male and female. The Greeks tell this story that, you know, they had 4 arms and 4 legs, and they used to travel by rolling like a spinning top. Guess you'd really get out of their way when you saw one of those things coming. But the gods felt that they were becoming too powerful, so they decided to slice them in half as punishment. Zeus threw his thunderbolt and split these people in half. And ever since then, we have been looking for our other half. They have this wonderful line that kind of sounds kind of naughty, but the desire and pursuit of the whole, whole, is called love. We're looking for our complement. And many of you here have found them, lucky you. So desire awakes in the third race. Before that, there were different ways of reproduction, but then as it split into male and female, desire awoke. And then in the fourth race, of course, Kama is the third race, Kama Manas. The mind is there, but it's a mind that is dealing with material things, a mind that is dealing with the world as we know it. And there's a lovely throwaway line in the Mahatma letters that the majority of people in this world belong to the fourth race, meaning that the material world still has a lot to offer them. They still have a lot to get out of it. We are now in the fifth race, and part of our work is to develop this buddhi manas. This is a wonderful line in one of Annie Besant's lectures, I think, in The Changing World. She said that when she came into the society as a young person, she heard the older students saying that part of our work was developed as theosophists, as forerunners, to develop this buddhi manas, this faculty that sees the unity in all things instead of divisiveness. May each who sees himself as one with thee know that he is also one with every other. To see our commonality, you know, that there's so much that we share that it's time we're aware. It's a small world after all, you know. We really have more in common than things that separate us. And part of our work through our studies is to develop this intuition, this intuitional faculty. And then, of course, the work ahead is to have that full intuition, that absolute knowing, that certainty that Kim was remarking about, that absolute certainty where we know, but it comes through this unity. She says the surest way to develop this intuition is, of course, through service, through brotherhood, through helping others. I tell you, one of the things Tim Boyd has taught me, if you ever see him on the road, he will listen to anybody at any time, even people where we in the lodge will desperately try to get away from. Tim will be there and giving that person his full attention. And I think, well, what is he listening to? Or can he just tune out? And it's somewhere else, you know, they say, you ever seen those cartoons about dogs, how they hear their masters, and we're talking and all they're hearing is, wurk, 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 wurk. So, you know, but it's, this is, you know, even you have taught me something, Tim. So, shows you the age of miracles is not over. There's hope for humanity after all, right? So intuition would be the sixth faculty developing. And the seventh is prana. Prana was not an individual thing. Prana isn't something that come and goes. I mean, if you don't have prana, if you don't have that breath, that life, you're dead. I mean, and as she says, there's no dead matter. There's no dead matter. To the switching and thinking that everything is alive. We are living in this wonderful world. This divine potential is there. And of course, prana, as you know, in the ancient Upanishads, was a synonym for Atman. Before it was Atman, it was prana. It was breath. The Upanishads give a story about the different parts of the body were at war, and they wanted to see who was the superior one. So sight left for a year, and the body walked around sightless. Touch left for a year, couldn't feel anything. Smell left for a year. Taste left for a year. And then finally, breath was going to get up and leave. And they all said, no, we recognize you, because once the breath was gone, as you know, for the longest time, they knew you were dead when they would hold that mirror to you and there was no breath, for the breath is the life. So this is something I would really all suggest to you to look at, because it's food for thought. It's, to me, soul food, right? This is the real soul food. And believe it or not, I'm still reading it, and I got a lot out of it. Let me tell you, you got to thank that somebody who did this. When I visited Nancy Blott's lodge in Oklahoma, something I'm still recovering from, it was held at a Unity Center. Unity is huge in Oklahoma. I mean, it is a major religion. And one of the things I saw there on the board, it said, thoughts held in mind produce effects after their own kind. Thoughts held in mind produce after their own kind. It's a nice, simple little thing. So again, the power of thought. This is one of Mrs. Besant's big thing, thought power, the power of thought. That as a man thinketh, so he is, right? That we allow so much negative thought to invade us. And then we beat ourselves up. Oh, I shouldn't be thinking that way. Oh, what am I doing? Well, you're surrounded by all of these influences. And all you're doing is accepting these negativities. You know, the people knocked the New Age, but one of the great contributions has been a book by Miguel Ruiz called The Four Agreements. And you read that book, it's like a commentary on Light on the Path. And one of his things is, don't take anything personally. Don't take anything personally. Because it's not about you, it's about the person who's giving it. The person is having the bad day, you know. And whenever people, you know, are mean or have been cold to me, I just say, oh, somebody needs a hug. And that, of course, inflames them even more. Part of the esoteric instructions is the voice of the silence. You've all seen that it's dedicated to the few, and we think, oh, the few people. But it's her school. It's to her pupils. Those are the few who have made that commitment. And it is a wonderful book that is worth study because it gives you the wonderful ideal of the bodhisattva. You know, I think HPB was one of the first people to introduce the Om into Western culture, because before that, who was talking about it? Who was using it? But the voice of the silence, because you read this stuff and it's all about data and theory and all of this stuff. I remember mentioning this once to our former president. She said, if data was enough, the world problems would have been solved by now. But the voice of the silence is the complement, because it shows you the ethical basis of this, the foundation of our belief, which is, you know, the wonderful ideal of the bodhisattva, you know, the one who is there for all of humanity, you know, holds all things in their heart, just to turn our thoughts toward this is wonderful. That the masters exist. This, you know, one of HVB's criticisms of the society is the masters got pushed aside. And many groups are talking about the masters now, but not us. That the masters are there as living realities is such a tremendously important thing. That they are there as examples for us, as things we can reach out to, and also to keep a little code of conduct a little better if you think they're always there. And as she points out, you don't want to cause them unhappiness, do you? You don't want to make the masters happy, do you? Unhappy? No, no. But of course, these esoteric instructions don't end here. They don't end with HPB. They don't end with anything done in the movement. It's an ongoing thing. We now have tremendous resources. The whole wealth of Buddhist teaching. Now there are swamis and yogis and lamas and rinpoches, you name it. They are all flooding America. There's a book called India Invades America, and there are all of these swamis and yogis and, you know, love is all you need. But one of the things, and it's actually published in a book by a theosophist, W. Evans Wentz, and I want to conclude with this idea. And the Bardo. HPB, actually the Mahatma Letters, is one of the first texts to mention the Bardo. The Bardo means simply an intermediate state. It's a state between something. So when you die, it's a state between something else. And there are six Bardos, as you know. Not Bridget Bardos, but just six Bardos. At the moment of birth, that's a Bardo. That gestation period in the womb is a Bardo, is a time period. Imagine that entity that's alive, that has some sort of awareness. That's all it knows. It's in this little interim period. Then the Bardo of dreams. When you dream, that's a different state. That's an intermediate state. The Bardo of meditation. When you meditate, that's a totally different state. The Bardo of the moment before death. You know, they say when you, this is a lovely line from the Mahatma Letters, when you are in the presence of death, speak ye in whispers, those of you in the presence of death, because the entity is having its review, it's putting it all together. It isn't like some movie that's being run, but in a moment, it's seeing the why, the wherefore, everything is put together. Then, of course, after death, there is that intermediate Bardo, and then the Bardo of becoming. So I'll just read you this as a nice happy ending to this, since you've been so patient. And it appears initially, it's part of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So now, when the Bardo of birth is dawning upon me, I will abandon laziness for which life has no time. Enter the undistracted path of study, reflection, and meditation. Service, study, meditation, right? Making projections in the mind the path and realize the three great kayas, vehicles. Now that I have once attained a human body, there is no time on the path for the mind to wander. Now when the Bardo of dreams is dawning upon me, I will abandon the corpse-like sleep of careless ignorance and let my thoughts enter their natural state without distraction, controlling and transforming dreams in luminosity. I will not sleep like any animal, but completely unify sleep and practice. When the Bardo of meditation dawns upon me, I will abandon the crowd of distractions and confusions and rest in the boundless state without grasping or disturbance. Firm in the two practices, visualization and complete, at this time of meditation, the one-pointed, free from activity, I will not fall into the power of confused emotions. Now when the Bardo of the moment before death dawns upon me, I will abandon all grasping, yearning, and attachment, enter undistracted into clear awareness of the teaching, and eject my consciousness into space of the unborn mind. As I leave the compound body of flesh and blood, I will know it to be a transitory illusion. Now when the bardo of the Dharmata dawns upon me, I will abandon all thoughts of fear and terror. I will recognize whatever appears as my projection and know that it is a vision of the bardo. Now that I have reached this crucial point, I will not fear the peaceful and wrathful ones, my own projections. All of these terrible things, or you realize they're your own projections. Now when the bardo of becoming dawns upon me, I will concentrate my mind one-pointedly and strive to prolong the results of good karma. Close the womb entrance and think of resistance. This is the time when perseverance and pure thought are needed. Abandon jealousy and meditate on the Guru. With mind far off, not thinking of debts coming, performing these meaningless activities, returning empty-handed now would be complete confusion. The need is recognition, holy Dharma. So why not practice Dharma at this very moment? From the mouths of the Siddhas come these words. If you do not keep your Guru's teachings in your heart, will you not become your own deceiver? If you do not keep your Guru's teaching in your heart, will you not become your own deceiver?